Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
What's your name, son?
Danny Bernstein. I'm from Deerfield, Illinois.
Dan Bernstein on Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score.
That's enough. Don't care. Not interested.
Insightful sports talk for your workday from one of Chicago's most respected radio professionals.
Professional what?
Professional penis.
You don't know what the hell you're doing.
Dan Bernstein.
The guy is full of hot air.
In a semi-permanent state of flatulence.
Middays on The Score.
Good morning and happy Friday as we broadcast live from the Hyundai Score Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. We'll be here until noon and we have a bunch of stuff for you. Ryan Dempster is going to join us at 9:20. Craig Calcaterra, the lead baseball writer at NBC Sports, at 9:40. Hub Arkish, I don't need to tell you his credentials as the Score's NFL and Bears leading expert. Our senior analyst is going to join us at 10 o'clock. We'll do the midday midway at 10:40, and we have some surprises along the way as well. 312-644-6767 is the number at WSCR The Score. You email us at Bernstein at 670thescore.com. That's where you listen to us live, because we stream at 670thescore.com. You want to send a text? Text the text zone. It is brought to you by Rosen Hyundai of Algonquin. Save time. Shop online at rosenhyundai.com. And listen very carefully. Where you have been texting is not where you're going to be texting. This is the new deal. The same number you call is the number you text. So you text us at that very same number that I gave out as the call-in number, 312-644-6767. That is how you get to the text zone. And when you text, we reply. Message and data rates may apply. Twitter is at Bernstein670. And you can also follow my personal account as well. That is at Dan_Bernstein. You must download the radio.com app to stream The Score on your mobile devices. You can interact with the show and the station on Facebook by liking the 670 The Score page. Jay Zawoski is our executive producer, and Ray Diaz is known as the Mexicutioner. He is the man who used to be in the back doing what he does, but now he's in the front still doing what he does. There was an interesting exchange via the media yesterday regarding the Cubs, and I'm fascinated by some of the public relations strategy behind it and why the Cubs chose to do what they did with a particular public response to being called out directly by one of the power brokers in baseball, and that is Scott Boras. Boras name-checked the Cubs when talking about what ownership has, what they say they have, and how the long-played shell game that we've discussed in detail about where actual money is. And I think this is a situation where both parties are correct. I just find the strategy in it to be fascinating here, because Boras really put it out there in a way that I hadn't heard articulated quite so neatly in a memorandum that was obtained by the Associated Press. And this is, Boras, remember, he represents 71 current players, Chris Bryant among them. And these were talking points in a memo. And he says specifically, let owners take some of their record revenues and profits from the past several years and pay you the prorated salaries you agreed to accept, or let them borrow against the asset values they created from the use of those profits players generated. So he points out that the Cubs are valued at $3.2 billion, according to Forbes. and Boris mentions debt financing and how the renovations of Wrigley Field and the developments around the park have allowed the Cubs to say, well, we're not really that profitable because we don't have all the – well, that's where the money's going. And he says throughout the process, they will be able to claim they never had any profits because those profits went to pay off their loans. The end result is that the Ricketts will own improved assets that significantly increases the value of the Cubs. Value not shared with the players. And the Tribune details here, their real estate company, Hickory Street Capital, that built and leases Hotel Zachary, the restaurants, the businesses, the office building, Gallagher Way, the plaza, the 11 rooftops they own, and the Hickory Street Capital assets that generate millions in combined revenues that don't go into the team. And that's true. There is no way to refute what Scott Boras is saying in this regard. It's absolutely true. And it also isn't necessarily a reflection of the Cubs' cash position. They could say that we don't have it because we poured it in here. There's asset value that's not liquid value. That's absolutely true. Then, if you're the Cubs, you figure, do we respond? Those are the conversations that go on. You first have to decide that. You first decide, are we going to talk about this? Are we going to give some kind of public response? And apparently, they decided, yeah, because they had their longtime spokesperson, Dennis Culleton, who is no rookie. This guy is a seasoned public relations veteran. And it seems to me like a decision like this is made because it's Scott Boras. If this were just some Wharton Business School professor or some sports business expert coming out saying, well, you know, the Cubs are making a ton of money hand over fist with all of the they've borrowed against some value for all this real estate that they've bought. And they're really a real estate business as much as a baseball business, which is kind of what they're becoming here, hospitality and real estate. But the fact that it came from Boras, the calculation is this guy generally has been villainized, that his Q rating across baseball, people have tended to not like him because he's been a symbol of what used to be looked at for a long time as unchecked player greed. However, it's different now, and this all feels different now because of a change in sentiment. For whatever reason, as we discussed in detail yesterday. But they did respond. And this is a response that does not really refute anything Boras said. And it was an opportunity for them to say some things and inject something into the bloodstream as this negotiation is going on and repeat some of their talking points. But I'm wondering what they thought would be the value in this statement. They said, here's their response. Paul Sullivan has it. The Ricketts family invested $750 million to save iconic Wrigley Field for fans today and for future generations. That's Ricketts family. Technically, not Cubs spokesperson, Ricketts family spokesman, Dennis Culleton. This is a statement to the Tribune. At every level, they've built the best player facilities in the game. In 2019, the Cubs had one of the top baseball payrolls in the game. The fact of the matter is 70% of the team's revenues, which support the baseball operations, come from having fans in the ballpark. Nevertheless, we thank Mr. Boras for weighing in. Okay, well, that's nice. That's great. It does nothing to refute, to illuminate anything that Boras alleged about what they can claim because of where the profits are going to debt service, to pay off loans, and to help them expand their footprint by investing in other assets that keep gaining in value. That Hickory Street Capital is not the Cubs, and they're not being asked in these negotiations by the players about Hickory Street Capital. So I might quibble on the 70% of the revenues and all coming from having fans in the ballpark. That's a number. They love that number. They've decided on that number. That's the one they're going to keep flogging out there. So I would quibble on that. But I just think it's really interesting that they would decide to do this because Boras isn't carrying the stigma he used to carry. And everywhere you look and everywhere you hear people discussing this current situation, he isn't the big villain he used to be. because there is a greater understanding of baseball business. Some of this has been unmasked in a way that it hasn't before. I'm not using that term loadedly in these uncertain and unprecedented times. But we put up a poll yesterday at Bernstein 670. And there's technically 2 minutes left to vote. And now 1 minute left. We have 60 seconds left to vote. The poll is up for 24 hours. And we literally put it up exactly 24 hours ago. And the way we phrased it was forced to pick a side in baseball's labor negotiations. Which side do you choose? And 83% of you said players. 83% of you said players. 5,427 votes. That is remarkable to me. Remarkable. Because there was a time not so long ago where I would have said 55-45 players would have been a story. Because it was always, and as we went into this, remember what we were saying, it was always so easy to paint the players as greedy. Always. And now it's not. So the Cubs' decision is to weigh in against Scott Boras is based maybe on an old calculus. I don't know if they understand exactly what the public sentiment is out there and how that makes people feel. And I don't know if you, the Cub fan, you could be standing up screaming or sitting in your car or wherever you are, while you're futzing around your house and you're listening on your smart speaker screaming, "No, I still hate that guy. I still..." But it just, to me, it doesn't land. That punch doesn't land as hard when you push back and say, "Well, it's Boras. Everybody's going to side against him." I don't necessarily think so. I think the owners, I think the billionaires in this climate are losing the public relations battle because they're not able to have people run away from the player's side quite as easily. And man, there was also, there's so much been going on social media for some of these minor leaguers. There was the annual bloodletting that happened where hundreds and hundreds of minor leaguers were just released. And here's the thing. And again, I was talking about how the pandemic, it's not creating new things. It's accelerating, illuminating, and intensifying things. You know how often hundreds of minor leaguers get released? Every year. That's the truth of it. Every single year. It feels different now because of everything that's going on with the shortening of the draft, the lowering of bonuses, the expected pairing off of minor league teams. But that those purges of minor leaguers, if you look at the number of players that come in any given draft, that happens every year. There are ex-minor league players, ex-pro players everywhere because it is nearly impossible to make it to the major leagues. There was a former Mets pitching prospect that got released that was going off and calling out Tim Tebow, calling out the organization, talking about how he played hurt. And there are a lot of hurt feelings out there, but I think there are people who hadn't seen this. Oh, wait a second. They let go of all these minor leaguers. Happens all the time. All the time. And when you least expect it. And I've been in the locker room. I can't tell you how many times I've been see a guy pulled out of the showers by the manager, and he's just been outright released. Your career is over in A-ball. Guys who were all conference players at major schools, guys who were all-star players, the best player their small town had ever seen, and a college star, and they're sitting in Fort Wayne or Rockford or Beloit and being told that, yeah, that's it. Your career's over. Go home. And there's nothing to it. The 708 texter points out your poll is not scientific. I know that. It's a Twitter poll. But I also know that anecdotally, all the other polls that we've seen, all the and feeling it out, you can sense it, the finger to the wind. The atmosphere right now has been more supportive of the players than I ever imagined it possibly could be. 630 says 83%, and my jaw dropped and is still hanging open. Would have never thought that that would be the result. I wouldn't either. When you put the poll up, I thought if it's 60-40, that's amazing. That is a turning of the tide. I do think Twitter skews to younger people. And I mentioned all the caveats yesterday of trying to glean too much from a result like that. Also, different shows select for different audiences with different preset notions of how they perceive the world in general sometimes. I mean, not every time, because people listen for different reasons. But I do think that there is an unscientific but meaningful way of looking at the size of that result. There's no arguing with that number of votes and that spread, that 83-17 in support of the players, there's meaning in that. And then when I see the Cubs deciding, well, the best thing we can do now, oh, perfect, Scott Boras has called us out, we're going to go right back at him because people love when you throw punches at Scott Boras. I just don't think they're landing in the same way. I think the Cubs have got a more difficult argument to make, in large part because of what's been their own doing. I think it's hard to have endured some of their own landmines that they laid out and stepped on themselves with emails and with trying to amusement tax grabs and other things that they've done. It hasn't been easy for them politically here, and whether they're aware of it or not. And look, I do think that their business model is in trouble. I think the Cubs, even though their value is very high and they're still worth what they're worth and everybody involved is going to be fine, they're not going to go hungry, I don't think it is unfair or unreasonable for them to talk about how they are more reliant on crowds and population density than other teams because they went all in as an entertainment real estate company around the park. That matters more to them than it does to other teams that have some far-flung park out near an airport and are making more money off their television deal with a pared-down payroll. The Cubs are trying to win. They do have they do spend a lot of money on players. They do spend a lot of money on things. Dennis Culleton's not lying. What he's saying is absolutely true. However, what Scott Boras is saying is also true about how they can move things around. So you can't declare a winner in this fight. It's just, to me, fascinating to think what the Cubs think they can do to sway public opinion in a way that might have been much easier long, long ago. We're going to talk some baseball and maybe some golf too, because he's been called out. There's been a challenge to Ryan Dempster, so he's going to join us next. I'm Dan Bernstein, and you have the Score.
A message to all Score listeners out there. We know a lot of you are working from home. We're with you because a lot of us are working from home too.
Tom Thayer is joining us.
I'm in my nephew's garage, which I refer to as Studio A.
I'm in my downstairs closet. This is the closest spot to the Wi-Fi.
I listen to you guys every day, and it kind of gives you that release from all the negativity if you only sat there and watched the news 24 hours. A day.
You're at home, we're at home, but we're all still connected with a love for Chicago sports on Sports Radio 670 The Score, our radio.com sports station.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago sports station.
I think everybody in that group has a charity or a cause that they would love to play for. I know that there's a bunch of people that would jump on board in Chicago to help sponsor it and see how much money we could raise. So I would love to do it. I think getting it on TV and giving people a little bit of live entertainment would be really fun.
That was Ian Happ during his regular weekly appearance. He's on Thursdays at 11 o'clock on this show on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Dan Bernstein with you, 9 to noon. We have been talking baseball, even though there is no baseball. There might be baseball. There's some optimism. There's some pessimism. There's some realism. And there's a whole lot of words being traded publicly. Here to talk some baseball with us is Ryan Dempster, who is on Twitter at Dempster46. He's on the Alpamonte Ford hotline. Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. He is also a multimedia superstar in his own right at the moment, because he is the host of the Off the Mound show and podcast. This is in all sorts of different venues right now, and the big show is coming up tomorrow. And Ryan, welcome. What are we going to see tomorrow on the Marquee Network? I believe this is Kyle Schwarber and Carlos Zambrano.
Yeah. Hey, good morning.
Hey.
Yeah, it's fun. It was great to sit down, obviously, with Kyle, catch up with him, see what he's doing in quarantine, getting ready for the season and possibly starting, and then to go down memory lane with Big Z and talk with Zambrano. So, I play with Carlos for a while on the north side, and he he's kind of a polarizing figure. You know, people didn't really understand him a lot, I think, personally, who he really was. And it was nice to just kind of hopefully get that across to people, what a good person he is. Every fifth day, we always said Big Z showed up, but Carlos the rest of the time was pretty awesome. So, you know, he was pretty intense when he was out on the mound, but he's one of the most, you know, lovable human beings I've been around otherwise. And, you know, it was nice to sit down with him, catch up with life, and see what's going on with him as well. It's been a ton of fun. I'm enjoying it a lot.
It airs Fridays, 8 o'clock on Marquee Sports Network, and all six episodes of Off the Mound are available in full for anyone on the website for Marquee Sports Network and MarqueeSportsNetwork.com, and there's also the Off the Mound podcast. It's amazing. I said the same thing to Len Casper. I said, with no baseball going on, you guys who can generate other kinds of content are actually busier, perhaps, than you otherwise would be.
Yeah, I find myself, you know, I'm like, whoa. Holy cow, I'm, you know, I'm taping interviews and filming stuff and segments and coming up with ideas and writing and questions. And, you know, it is fun to be busy during a time where, you know, it can be pretty frustrating. It keeps your mind focused on that and off other things. And, you know, I find between that and four kids, I'm going nonstop. So it's a really good thing. And I'm glad to give this to baseball fans. You know, that's been my idea with the show the whole time was, you know, just kind of diving into, you know, memories and laughs and stories and, you know, really, really had a ton of fun with it. The guests have all been great. We've had, you know, anything from serious to a lot of fun joking about things. And, you know, like you said, for anybody who hasn't seen any of the shows, if you go to the website or even download the Marquee app, you can see the past shows that we've done. And we're just really excited. We got a great show again next week too, with Ken Griffey Jr. coming on. So he, as much of an icon as he is, he gets his own show. So it's just him the whole show, which is going to be a ton of fun.
You heard that sound from Ian Happ yesterday. He and his buddies at the compound were watching the challenge match with Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Tom Brady, and Peyton Manning. And someone emailed them and or tweeted them and said, you know what, you guys should set up something similar. And it should be Ian Happ and John Lester against Kerry Wood and Ryan Dempster for the same kind of charitable effort. Are you in?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? And I love how Happer, he's trying to get the two, you know, the two current guys to take down, not that John Lester's a young guy, but he's trying to take down the old guys. We'll take that on any day of the week. And it's not going to be the quality of golf as Tiger or Phil. I would expect something more around Peyton. Definitely not what Tom Brady threw out there. But I'm just kidding. Isn't it amazing that Tom Brady? That's how much of the goat he is. Is that even when he has a terrible day on the golf course, he finds a way to have the most you know, memorable moment, the best shot of the day, the iconic shot of the day. So I enjoyed watching. I thought it was so great to hear the banter that those guys were having. And I admired them too for playing in the pouring down rain and not putting the kibosh on it and saying, nope, we're playing, we're going after it. So Happer, if you want it, come get it.
I am always amazed by how hard golf is, both when I'm playing and when I'm watching, because sometimes we use that term of making it look easy. And the guys at the highest levels, you're talking of Phil and Tiger, who are two of the greatest to ever pick up a club. Any human beings ever walked the planet to do that. And then to see the ease with which they're able to make some of these shots. Then you have two pro athletes who are two of the best of all time at one of the most difficult individual positions in pro sports. And they're good at golf. But to see how stark the difference is between them and the two all-time greats is, just from a sports fan perspective, it's really meaningful to me.
Yeah, no, it is. It just shows you, you know, especially, you know, at those elite levels, like, you know, people will say, oh, man, I don't understand how you can throw a pitch, you know, on a dime from 60 feet, 6 inches over and over. And, you know, I said, well, it comes with years and years and years of practice, obviously. And just like those guys, you know, we have a tough time wrapping our head around how they're that good at golf. And then, you know, you watch the work that they put in. Obviously, there's ability there, but the work in golf is amazing. And these guys, you know, they'll practice for 2 hours beforehand. They'll go play, and if they're not happy with their 68 they shot, they'll go back out to the range and work on their wedge game. So it's really, really incredible the work they put in. And, you know, I've had a chance to be inside the ropes for some pro-ams and, you know, just to watch how far they hit it. And then, like, I understand how Phil and sorry, how Peyton and Tom felt. You know, when you get to that first tee and you're playing in something like that where you're there's people, you know, watching. They know there's people watching at home. I did that at Conway Farms for the Pro-Am, and Jonathan Begas was my partner, and I'm feeling good. I practiced well at the range. The first tee shot, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to hit a 5-iron down the middle here, and I hit it about 120 yards in the rough right in front of me, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, man. I was just so nervous. And then you start to open up, and you start to feel a little bit better and realize that your game's not even at its top anywhere near what these guys can do with a golf ball. It's really amazing to watch guys who are that good at the top of their sport firsthand.
When you're talking to current players right now, how would you describe the mood when it comes to optimism, pessimism regarding the game's return?
Yeah, I think that guys are genuinely, you know, optimistic that it will happen. They want it to happen. It just, you know, and these things take some time, and obviously there's a lot going on right now that you know, needs to be resolved. But from some of the guys that I talk to, they, you know, they want to play. Hopefully they feel like it'll happen, and hopefully the two sides can come to an agreement and that works out.
It does sound like that there is going to be some engagement caused by the initial exchange or non-exchange of proposals. It was like, yeah, no, we're not doing this. Come back to us when you're serious with something. And I never know if what looks like a roadblock in a negotiation is often the stimulus for real talk. How much of it is posturing? But the fact is they don't have time. The timetable to do this, they're up against it if they want to salvage something. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it drops the pretense sooner than it otherwise would be dropped.
Yeah, well, I think any negotiations anywhere seem to tend to prove that, right? If you have a timeline, you say we need a new deal done 3 months from now, nothing ever gets done 3 months ahead. It's always down to the last minute most of the time. You know, when you're dealing with, you know, two really big sides and a players union and an owners union and owners side, it seems like that's over the history often been the case. When you're talking about major issues, it usually goes down to the last minute, so... I don't see this being any different. Obviously, we know that owners want the players out there playing, and the players want to be out there playing, and they're going to continue to do that. And you know, would it shock me if it went all the way down to the final minute and get it done? No, not at all, because I've been in that position before. I've been in the players rep in Cincinnati in 2003 where we were not going to get on a bus to go play because there was a possibility that we would go on strike, and we didn't. We got it done. So that's why I look at it, and I look at it like, all right, they're going to work hard to try and get this done and get some baseball out there as long as health protocols and safety measures are taken so that everybody's, being looked after and safety is first and foremost for the players, staff, coaches, everybody involved to get back out there and play some baseball. And we all know we'd love to see it, and hopefully that ends up happening.
Did you enjoy being a player rep?
I did from the sense of, like, you know, learning the intricacies and the nuances and the ins and outs and, what kind of goes on behind the scenes. It's a tough task. It's not an easy thing to just sign your name down on that paper. I'll be the rep. You're representing an entire team, and, your voice is heard, and you're not only relaying messages from your team to your players association, and then you're standing up for your union and doing different things like that. So it was an incredible experience, something that I'm glad I got a chance to do and kind of see what that side's all about.
I'm thinking about older pitchers trying to return right now or trying to prepare for the potential of a return, those guys who are lucky to be able to work out. We heard John Lester over the weekend was on in a wide-ranging interview talking about how he's staying in shape. But it can't be easy for some of these guys who are set in their ways, who have a routine. And I know always the pitchers, especially starting pitchers, are creatures of their routine. They know what works for them, but nobody knows what works now. And even pitchers who stretch out and they plan for whatever you call it, a dead arm period, or they plan on some kind of recovery period where there is often a velocity drop in spring training that comes back up. What do you do now? I mean, how do these guys operate kind of flying blind when it comes to their own bodies?
Yeah, you're right. And I think that's one thing that's kind of important to remember when you are getting ready is, is don't panic. Don't think, man, I'm behind or I'm not as ready as somebody else, because everybody's going through this for the first time together. And, you know, as long as you've kept your arm moving throughout this and not just, you know, put your glove and ball away and not play catch and not thrown, then yeah, I feel like you're going to be fine. And, you know, you're physically, there's some guys who've been getting after it like crazy, and some guys I'm sure have been a little bit more relaxed, and that'll show on the playing field. But, you know, for pitchers and for older pitchers, I was actually kind of thinking, like, a guy like John Lester, like, wow, now I only have to pitch a half a year. I can empty the tank right away, because as an older pitcher, you tend to, you know, manage your innings and manage your high stress as much as you can throughout a season, you know, whether that's backing off bullpens in July because you've already pitched a couple months, or have a half.
Sounds like we're having some issues with the phone line with Ryan Dempster. So we are going to try to reestablish contact with him and continue the conversation. I'm Dan Bernstein. This is Sports Radio 670 WSCR. The Score. Craig Calcaterra is going to join us in a few moments. He of NBC Sports, their lead baseball columnist. We're going to talk to him about what he's been following in the labor negotiation and elsewhere, what's happening in the minor leagues, what is going on with the draft. Hub Arkish at 10. Midday Midway at 10:40. Always fun on Fridays. Talk a little bit more baseball at 11. Got all sorts of cool stuff that we're doing in the 11 o'clock hour as well. We had started the show by talking about Scott Boras and talking about his decision to call out the Cubs directly. And it's been fascinating to see some of the response. So we're going to get to that too. And because the text line was blowing up with some thoughts there. We've got Ryan Dempster back on the line. Yeah, Ryan, we were talking about older pitchers getting ready, and you're talking about emptying the tank. And I was thinking too, and back to your comment about when you say, am I behind, and you look at other guys, is that something that players would do when you've got that line of pitching mounds and guys are you got 10 guys in a row all throwing at once? Are you noticing, you know, different sounds of a ball hitting a glove and thinking, ooh, that guy's throwing a lot harder than I am right now?
Yeah, 100%. I've been on that mound, you know, and you're throwing a bullpen, and all of a sudden it's like, whack, whack. My first thought that goes through my head is, wow, that guy's throwing some cheese. But then my second thought is, yeah, but can he throw where he wants it to? And so that's the key. You know, you can throw all the velocity in the world, but unless you're throwing it where you want, you know, and that ultimately is what's going to get a lot of pitchers through this is, you know, did you keep throwing and keep your arm in shape so that you can locate? And if you locate, you know, I truly believe, I think the new norm and the guys that can dominate are going to be some of the softer throwers, because guys are just geared up to hit velocity so much now. So it'd be interesting. I'm looking forward to see what happens if John Lester gets a half a season instead of having to worry about pitching for a full season.
You know, I was wondering too, that's the double-edged sword of all the measurables right now, is that as technology has advanced, that they can hook up to their edutronic cameras and Rapsodo machines, and every pitcher can watch every bit of film of every pitch that leaves its hand with the last touch of a finger on a seam. And now you know your spin rate on every pitch. You know the velocity. You know it's not just a scout, you know, spitting tobacco and saying, well, he's got good glove side run. You know, it's all measurable right now. That can make it worse, because if we don't have a career's worth of data, you don't know how to compare. You say, well, okay, well, usually in April, whatever, my spin rate is this, and this year it's this. It's got to be kind of scary if you start seeing numbers drop, because you don't have the sample size to know what's good, bad, right, or even meaningful to extract the signal from the noise.
Yeah, well, exactly. And don't allow one pitch to determine that's what was successful. Like, just because you throw one pitch and you get a swing and miss and you look at your spin rate and you're like, okay, I got to do that. And then you do that and you get hit three or four times. You need some data. And at the same time, of all of those things, great, but your eyes are going to be your biggest weapon you have. And that's seeing what's happening that day in that moment. We have data because it's been collected and, you know, over the course of, you know, thousands of pitches, it probably plays out, but each individual start or outing or inning as a pitcher, they're all each into themselves. And
And so what happens is, like, you know, a perfect example, Kyle Hendricks facing the St. Louis Cardinals last year. St. Louis plays a night game in Washington, flies to Chicago, has to play a day game on a Friday against the Cubs. Kyle Hendricks throws the first pitch of the game down the middle, and the guy gets out, pops it up, 85. Then he throws a couple more pitches down the middle, and they're grounding out. They're popping up. He's throwing 85 to 88, and he's not painting the corners. He's just attacking the strike zone to a team that was tired and came in late, and they're fatigued, and they're getting outs. And so he just was smart enough to see his eyes and go, wow, I'm just going to keep doing this. Next thing you know, he throws a Greg Maddux game where he throws less than 90 pitches in a complete game. So that's where, like, you can have all the data in the world and all of those analytics, and they're great. But at the end of the day, that moment in time is all that matters, because sometimes somebody's just not clicking, the elements, whatever it is, come into play, and all of that data can just go out of the window, and you just go with what you're seeing, and it ends up being, you know, really what works best that day.
Ryan, last thing for you, and I found it fascinating, your thought about Lester. And how that idea of attacking a shortened season differently, what other ways could that be done? Obviously, managers could deploy players differently, knowing if you only have a half season, it just changes the way you marshal your resources here. I'm wondering, from a player's perspective, maybe from a position player's perspective, maybe a catcher being able to catch more innings than he otherwise would, or just, I know baseball isn't a game that can be played harder, but what else aren't we thinking about in how a truncated schedule could affect strategy and effort?
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I think what you'll see is, because one, you're going to get a ramp up of, you know, guys getting ready for the season. So you got to be careful initially to make sure that guys are ready. But the dog days of summer are going to be upon you. You're going to be jumping right into those. So once guys have gotten their legs under them and they're ready to go, you don't have to worry about giving guys a blow. You don't have to say, you need a day off. You know, you've played this many days in a row. We got to make sure you're ready for October. No, you can lean on guys. Like you said, guys can catch more days in a row. They can catch a night game or a day game after a night game and those kind of things because of that very reason, because you're going to have the ability to not have to save something and save energy in the tank because they're only going to play half a season. And I think that's going to be really, really fun to watch. You know, the way it could play out, the excitement of it all, there's not going to be any strategy as to how do I manage this over 162 plus the playoffs. It's almost like comparing a starting pitcher to a reliever. As a starting pitcher, you know, I can take my time setting you up in the first inning for maybe an at-bat later in the seventh, your third time through the lineup. As a reliever, it's kitchen sink right now, and let's go, because I don't got time. I'm only going to face you once. And it kind of could come the same way in approaching a game plan throughout the course of a shortened season. And whatever happens, it's going to be exciting, because you're going to have not only players that way, but you're going to have teams too that way that are going to be in it that wouldn't necessarily be in it because of a shortened season. And hopefully we get some baseball to watch it all, because I think it could be great for our spirits in the country, great for baseball fans to watch it, and great for teams out there who might not necessarily have a high payroll and their teams can be in it all the way till the end of this short season. It could be a lot of really exciting things.
Ryan Dempster, great stuff. It is Off the Mound, and it's going to be tonight, 8 p.m., Marquee Sports Network. Always appreciate the time. Thanks, Ryan.
Hey, absolutely, Dan. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
That's Ryan Dempster. You can follow him on Twitter at Dempster46. Craig Calcaterra, one of the brightest minds covering baseball, will join us next. I'm Dan Bernstein. You have the score.
Cubs fans, while you're stuck at home, we're re-airing classic regular season Cubs games from the 2016 championship season. Tonight at 6, we take you back to June 19th, 2016, Cubs versus Pirates. Wilson Contreras sees his first big league pitch.
That ball is gone for a home run. Wilson Contreras has just homered to center on the first pitch he ever sees in the big leagues.
Tonight at 6 on Sports Radio 670, The Score. Chicago's official radio home of the Cubs. Brought to you by Xfinity, Wintrust, Hefty Trash Bags, The Village of New Lenox, Marathon, Lakeshore Recycling System, Funkaway Odor Eliminator, and Loyola Medicine.
This is Sports Radio 670, The Score, and 670thescore.com, Chicago's sports station.
As much as we don't want this to play out in the media, and I think, like I said last week, The best thing for us to do is to send proposals back and forth and announce it when it's done. But it's positive. Any traction on the two sides sending proposals back and forth is positive. And I think that's what the fans should take from this, is that there's conversations happening, and we're getting closer to a deal, no matter how far off we are on these proposals from either side. Sending them back and forth is getting us closer to a deal. So I think there's nothing but positives coming out of the two sides talking.
Well, that's a more sanguine take than others have had. Ian Happ expressing some optimism as the talks continue, as in whatever form they may be, and maybe having them done privately is better than having them done publicly, but people want baseball to return one way or another, as long as it's fair. Craig Calcaterra is on Twitter at Craig Calcaterra, the lead baseball writer for NBC Sports. He joins us now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Craig, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, and I'm amazed at some aspects of the current discussion that we're having. And I know Twitter polls are unscientific. I know a lot of this evidence is anecdotal. But something has happened. Something in the zeitgeist has changed regarding the way we look at players versus owners. And something's changed very, very positively. When, as we entered this and we saw that this was, that these talks were going to start, we all went in, those of us of a certain age and experience, went in with the assumption that it was going to be easy to paint the players, the wealthy players, as greedy, 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 and intractable. And it's not happening in large part. I've really been heartened by so much evidence that people are turning against the billionaire plutocrats faster than they're turning against some of these players. I think that's, it's a good thing. It's a positive evolution. Are you feeling that too?
It's definitely different than it was in the past. I'm of an age where I was an adult during the 94-95 strike. I was online as one could be in 2002, the last time they had a really contentious bargaining session over the collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, obviously you would remember yourself that at that time, and always really in baseball history, the fans have been like, hey, you guys are paid to play a kid's game. You're millionaires, go play. That's certainly not as prevalent now as it was. I think the biggest reason is there are more voices. I mean, in 1994, you got your information about the strike from someone on ESPN who probably had a source with someone in a front office, not with the players. Anytime until the age of social media, you really were only hearing probably one side of it, because baseball teams and the commissioner's office have always had a pretty good PR operation. The players union has never had a good PR operation. And, you know, players aren't always the best spokesman for their own cause. Sometimes we saw that even this time with Blake Snell a couple of weeks ago. So, now, though, you got a lot of voices, whether it's labor law voices who are explaining to people what's going on, players who are, you know, their own good spokesmen who are going on social media and explaining their side of the story. It's also the case that a lot of these ownership groups are sort of faceless now, right? You don't have the long-term owner who brought the team to town and everybody, you know, love him or hate him, knows him very well. You've got a bunch of people who are part of some private equity group who bought the team on a leveraged buyout a few years ago and are trying to make a buck on it. That's not exactly a really popular spokesman for the team.
I never thought of it that way, that it isn't like the area car dealer or the area, you know, real estate mogul who happens to be the local guy who owns the baseball team. That maybe that there's a disconnection there that I hadn't thought about. I think there's a larger scale sort of secular shift in thinking, at least for people under 45. And I obviously can't speak for them since I'm 50. But it does seem to me that a generation of people who have had their futures taken away from them in some part by what you describe, these private equity firms sucking up assets, stripping them down and selling them off just for brand value. What some kids have seen as an unfair socioeconomic system stacked against them, it has to fundamentally change the way they think about some of these ownership groups, whether it's subconscious or active.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody wants to pretend sports happen in a vacuum and, you know, the whole stick to sports thing. And, that's just where we go for entertainment, and the rest of the real world doesn't intrude. That's a fiction. That doesn't happen that way. And you can just look around the rest of society, what people's attitudes are. I mean, I'm not going to say that, you know, rising socialism or young people who are progressives or whatever are the majority in the country. But in a certain age group, they're certainly well more representative than they used to be. The same sort of people who are questioning corporate power, who are questioning Wall Street, who are questioning anything, those people are sports fans too. And they see the same dynamic. It's pretty easy to see, for example, when some private business goes in and buys a retail chain and then loots it and then it goes out of business for some reason. People see what happens there, and they see that's exactly what happens in some sense with a Major League Baseball team. I mean, when you go into debt, like 98% debt level, to buy the Kansas City Royals because you want to flip them in a few years, kids in Kansas City are like, well, wait a minute, why are they doing that to our team? It's not exactly unrelated to what's going on in the larger world.
I also think that the absence of baseball has in large part made the heart grow fonder, and we spent a lot of time decrying what the bad aspects of the game that had been exacerbated by analytics and velocity and the lack of balls in play and the strikeouts and the lack of action, the length of games, and picking it apart and saying, okay, you know, the average fan's a 57-year-old white man, baseball's in trouble, baseball isn't compelling, young kids can't sit through a whole game. And now, when you take it away, and people are we're going about our lives without the whatever it may be, the connective tissue that it gives people, the fabric of it, this just the fact that it's not there is such a noticeable absence that I wonder if we're individually recalculating what baseball actually means to us, as much fun as we've had nitpicking what we don't like about it in this curmudgeonly sense, that this the absence of it is romanticizing the game again for some of us.
Oh, I think that's definitely the case. You know, it's funny. Baseball has always been treated a little bit differently than other sports. You know, when people think about baseball, they like to complain a lot about baseball. And then that becomes this larger, oh, baseball is dying, baseball is horrible sort of thing. Look at the NFL. I don't know how online you are during games on social media, like on a Sunday afternoon. I'm not even a football fan myself. But if you were just to follow pro football by being on Twitter or something, you would think that everyone who's a big football fan absolutely hates football. I mean, they talk about how terrible the quarterbacks are. They talk about how dumb their coaches. They talk about how miserable it is to watch their team. And this is like for people who are following like 10 and 16 who are playoff bound. This is ridiculous, right? That's the sense. But they love it, and they're devoted to it, and they go back to it constantly. It's the most popular thing in America. Baseball hasn't really had that. People have the complaints about it, and then there's this national conversation of, are we tuning it out as baseball past its prime? I think we're now starting to fall back into the sort of football mode of, God, everything about baseball stinks. Boy, I miss it. And, you know, it's just a timing thing more than anything else given all that's going on in the world.
Yeah, I guess I've said this repeatedly. That's one thing that the pandemic has done. It hasn't necessarily created any new forces in our society, but it has illuminated them, it's intensified them, and it's accelerated the effects of them. More for the worse than the better, I think. But if maybe all that we're going through allows us to recalibrate how we feel about baseball, as long as there's smart people involved in the discussion, I think it could be a good thing. I think instead of just sort of lobbing insults or saying, I hate it, I don't like your team, or I don't like this guy, I don't like that guy, maybe that if we're getting close to the brink of baseball being in some kind of business trouble here, which it may be, that the next iteration of it could be for the better.
Oh, I agree. And again, you know, look at how hungry people are for anything that's either interesting, fun, something that gives them fun memories. I mean, how many people watched that Michael Jordan documentary that might not have watched it if it came out a year ago? I mean, it would have been popular anyway because he's Michael Jordan, but nowhere near the phenomenon that it was. You know, this weekend, I think Major League MLB Network or whatever is going to run 64 straight hours of Derek Jeter content. If there's not anything that's going to make you miss real baseball, current baseball, than watching 64 hours of Derek Jeter, I don't know what will.
Yeah, no thank you. I think I've got the big I'm not interested sign on that, especially now that Derek Jeter has joined exactly the ownership class that we were just decrying.
All I know is I saw the press release for that, and I thought it was a threat more than an advertisement. So it was kind of scary.
Are you interested in the documentary of the 98 home run chase with Sosa and McGuire?
You know, probably a little bit because it's faded in my mind a little. I don't know how much I'll watch it because I've written so much about it and everything. But I think we're definitely due for, you know, I don't know what your listeners think about it, but I think we're definitely due for a Sammy Sosa reassessment at this time in life. I think there's not a guy that came through that period and then through all the turmoil that came afterwards that's gotten less of a fair shake than Sammy Sosa, in my view. So.
Yeah, that's a controversial opinion among some Cub fans, but I, like you say, I've looked back on the way, and not just his, and I covered those teams, and I was in those clubhouses, and I know how his teammates thought about him, and there was some toxic stuff that was going on.
Oh yeah.
But you can't argue with the production, and I've stopped doing it, and I've stopped saying, you know, trying to be the judge and jury of steroid guy, not steroid guy. I think the numbers are the numbers. I think we've got drug abusers and performance-enhancing drug abusers among the all-time greats who are in the Hall of Fame. So, yeah, I think there is a reckoning and a reconsideration that probably should happen.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think that the Ricketts family has an asset and like they do in the Chicago Cubs if it was of its value, if it wasn't for a lot of work in Sammy Sosa to that team. So maybe he was a jerk, maybe he cheated, but you know, I think Cubs baseball looks very, very different coming into the 21st century without him.
Craig, always good catching up. Look forward to the next time we get to talk. Have a good weekend.
Thanks a lot.
That is Craig Calcaterra, lead baseball writer for NBC Sports. Hub Arkish talks football next on The Score.
This is 670 The Score, Chicago's number one and most listened to sports station, period. Thanks for keeping us on top, Chicago.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.